The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538.
Deep in my heart, I do believe someday we'll all be free. We will be free. I may not know how long 'twill be.
Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Wintley Phipps. As you all know, many of you know who even watch Politics and Life and saw him sing Amazing Grace in an amazing way at the inaugural prayer breakfast for Barack Obama. He's one of America's leading noted gospel singers, a pastor in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, an educational activist, a two-time Grammy Award nominee, and founder of the U.S. Dream Academy, which is a national mentoring and tutoring program for children whose parents are in prison or who kids who really need arms wrapped around them. And Baltimore has one of those Dream Academies right here, the Dream Academy Learning Center, which is at the old Pimlico Elementary Middle School. And Wintley Phipps, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
Oh, it's a pleasure. I'm so happy that you're coming to Baltimore. I know you'll be here Sunday, September 26th at the Brown Memorial Park Avenue Church, part of their Tiffany series. It's a great church, a really socially active church, and you can find out more about this at browndowntown.org or at 410-523-1542. We'll do that later in the program and have it up on our website as well.
Great.
Tell me about the genesis of Dream Academy for you and where this all began.
Yeah, well, I have been blessed in my music career. I've been blessed to sing for every president since Ronald Reagan, and I've just had some wonderful experiences, and they've been really eclectic, from Billy Graham Crusades to Saturday Night Live and Soul Train. I was the first gospel artist on Soul Train in 1978.
Really?
But I started doing, about almost 30 years ago, I started doing a lot of singing in prisons in America, and I was literally shaken by what I saw. I did not know that one of every three African-American males between the ages of 18 and 30 are in prison in America or on probation or parole. When I visited the prisons, I saw so many young men who looked like my sons, and they were there, many of them in their 20s, and they were there for 10, 15-year sentences. And then I started helping a group, a ministry that has a program called Angel Tree, where they give gifts to children at Christmas time. And while on the board of the ministry, a very disturbing statistic surfaced almost 25 years ago, that children of prisoners are six times more likely to end up in prison. In other words, between 60 and 70% of the kids who end up in prison come from the children of those who are in prison now.
Yeah.
And so I began to advocate, listen, let's try to stem this tide and break this cycle. And I was asked by President Clinton at the time and Speaker of the House to study the problem and try to figure out what are the most effective interventions to break that cycle of intergenerational incarceration. So many in our churches, in our communities, if you ask how many of you have family members, or brothers or sisters, parents who are in prison, it is incredible how, 60, 70% of the people in our communities will put their hands up, because all of us have been touched by this awful scourge. And so as we studied the problem, we brought in experts from Princeton and University of Michigan, and the two things that were most effective in helping to break that cycle of intergenerational incarceration were, number one, you have to increase the density of adults in the life orbit of children whose parents are incarcerated. In other words, when a child has no father or no mother for guidance, for discipline, it's a prescription for disaster. And so that's why the church is so important, because you have a chance for a child to be touched 3 and 4 and 5 times in a day with an encouraging word. You know, that old sister that leans down to that 8-year-old kid say, "Boy, you're gonna be somebody." You know, I mean, that's incalculable. There's no substitute for it. You know, and to have that happen a few times in a child's life, you and I go back. You know, you remember growing up, that little word that was whispered to you, or that little action that just validated your dignity and your personhood. There's just no substitute for it. And then the other thing that we found, interestingly enough, that helps to break that cycle of intergenerational incarceration happened to be interactive, tutorial, corrective, academic support. It is not an accident that the ranks of the juvenile offenders are not filled with successful students.
Mm-hmm.
There is an unusual link between school failure and incarceration. When a child is not interested, when a child is not doing well in school, that's another prescription for disaster. But most of our kids are not doing well because they're not given the academic corrective help that they need to do well. You know, it blew me away when I started this work, when I realized that when a child in our school systems receives a bad grade from a teacher, almost never, ever, ever is that bad grade handed back to the child with tutorials and instruction and corrective help to fix the problem they didn't understand that caused them to get a bad grade in the first place. It's the only place where we routinely do diagnosis and never do a prescription, and we call it education. And our kids are suffering under intense failure simply because no one comes alongside of them after they have not done well with the corrective help and instruction they need. And so the Dream Academy has been built around tutoring and assessing where the kids need academic support, and then focusing academic help on where they are weak academically. And we're also built around increasing the density of these adults by bringing mentors in to mentor children who are not doing well in school and who are falling behind in school. And our three major foundational pillars of the work we do are skill building, which is, again, academics and other skills, life skills. We do skill building. We do character building, and we focus on dream building, building the dreams of the kids to believe in the dream that's in their heart. And we've been fortunate to do that in cities across the country, you know, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New Jersey, Houston, Memphis, Salt Lake City, Los Angeles, Indianapolis, Orlando, and that's what we do, and it's very exciting work.
So these schools that you have, the Dream Academies, are they... Are these schools where you move in to manage an existing school in terms of these principles that you all believe in, or are these schools that you actually take over and manage the academic direction as well?
No, they are literally after school
programs. These are after school programs, right?
These are after school programs. So the kids after school come, and we support the work that the teachers are doing with those kids. We help them with the homework that they're doing, and if they don't understand, we focus, again, corrective instruction on what they don't understand. And so it's an after-school program.
So I'm curious just in terms of just your own life and the shock, when you talked about the shock of going into prison.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about when I was reading about your biography and reading that You grew up, I think your parents are Trinidad, and you grew up in Canada for the most part.
Yeah.
And that as any man, any black man in America, in the Americas, knows what racism is and discrimination is. You can't walk through life
absolutely
without having that hit you at some point.
Absolutely.
But I was thinking about the shock for you in coming from the environment of really mostly stable environment of the community in Canada you came from, the West Indian community, and then coming into that prison. I mean, that must have been just also viscerally and emotionally and spiritually a deep shock.
Yes, it is, and it was. And, you know, I was on my journey, of course, in the sense that I didn't grow up in a strong nuclear family. And really, in many ways, I was a candidate for the same kinds of troubles and difficulties trying to find myself. You know, you're probably old enough to remember this, but when I was growing up in the 60s, musically, I wanted to be another Sly Stone. You know what I mean?
I like Sly.
Sly was a genius, you know. But yep. but then I met Sly when I was 15 years old, and he was stoned. And I said, "No, something's wrong with this picture," you know. and so I was really a candidate for just some going the wrong way and making the wrong decisions as well, because I did not have a strong nuclear family. As a matter of fact, it's one of the reasons that I passionately have held on to my own family, and wanted to build something that I did not have as a child, and that is a family. And so my wife, we've been married 34 years.
Congratulations.
My wife, thank you. And my wife, I tell people, she's the only woman I know that has been kissed by the man who loves her on every continent of the world. You know, that way.
I like that.
You know, and so... But you make a very important point. The other thing too that was really compelling was that once I don't care, and you know this, no matter where you come from or where you come from as a black man, when you are immersed in American society, you can try to hide it all you want, or try to duck and weave all you want, but you're going to come face to face with it. It's going to hit you and your family. And of course, my wife, we married. My wife is from Florida, and literally, I remember singing in a prison in Marion, Florida. I sang at the men's prison. It was Easter Sunday morning. And I started to hum Amazing Grace, and all the prisoners got up out of their seats and stood at attention.
Wow!
Without being told. They just, it was like that song was the national anthem of sinners. And ever since then, I call it the national anthem of sinners.
Well, it is. I mean, it's rooted in England as an anti-slavery song written by a white minister.
Yeah, and you know? I don't know if you got the chance to see this, but someone took my performance of that song and uploaded it to YouTube.
Yes, I've seen it. Yeah.
And it has become, you know, the most watched Christian music video in the world by a Christian artist on the internet. It's just been, I can't take credit for it because I didn't put it up, you know, that kind of thing. But I left the men's prison, I went over to the women's prison, and when I finished singing Amazing Grace over there, a young lady came up to me pregnant, about to have her baby in prison. And she said, "Excuse me, sir." Tears in her eyes. I said, "Yeah." She said, "Your wife named Linda." I said, "Yes." She said, "That's my aunt."
Oh, my God.
And then we started to kind of count it up, and all of my wife's brothers and sisters at some point in their lives, you know, eight of them have been incarcerated or in prison at some point in their lives. My wife, again, that cycle, those things that helped to break the cycle became a part of her life. She lived next door to a concerned Christian family. And when she was 4 or 5 years old, they would take her they increase the density of caring, loving adults. They validated her dignity, her humanity, and and when they said grace at a table, she'd see a family saying grace when they had worship as a family, and a dream was born in a little girl's heart. You know, God, that's what I want for my life when I grow up. You know, when they bought her little church dresses that they kept pressed and cleaned at their house. So if she wanted to wear those pretty dresses, she went to church. I call it Holy Ghost bribery, you know. But
it worked, though, right? It worked.
You know, but she, you know, when she was away from that cussing and fussing and shooting and stabbing and liquor and gambling and drugs and the numbers and all of that, she started growing up in her own house as a little girl, 3, 4, 5 years old. But on the weekend, she had this sanctuary, and this dream was born in her heart. And then they put some money together, sent her away from her community.
This family did.
Yeah, and the church family, so that she could, you know, she went to a hospital in Nashville, Tennessee, where she could become a licensed practical nurse. And she became an LPN, and then she went on to college so she could prepare to be an RN. In 1973, that's where I met her in Huntsville, Alabama.
Wow.
And, you know, so I went. My route has really been weird, man. It started in Trinidad, where I was born. I grew up in Montreal, and then in 1972, I hitched a ride, ended up in Huntsville, Alabama.
Oh, you weren't performing then?
No, I was going. That's where I went to school. Oh. That's where I went to college. I heard about this college, Oakwood University, down in Huntsville, Alabama. It was great for music. Folks like Take Six came out of there, and Little Richard used to go there.
Really? Little Richard?
Know. Yeah. So I hitched a ride and went on down to the school. Clifton Davis, you know, graduated from there. And so I went on down to this school and loved it and met my wife there. And she's been a great support as I do this work all over the country. I spend a lot of time on planes now, running around the country. This time I'm singing and begging with dignity. You know? He's trying to raise money for this work.
That's a lovely story. I mean, biographical question. I have some other questions too.
Yeah, sure.
Were you raised as a Seventh-day Adventist? Is that why you became a minister in that church?
Well, yes. But I would say more importantly, in my Sly Stone years, I was searching. I was lost. You know, as a matter of fact, let me tell you this interesting story. When I met Sly, and I said, "Nah, I don't think that's what I wanted for my life." You know, I was still trying to maybe look for the entertainment business as my ticket to my destiny, to my dreams. You know. And I found a voice teacher on the radio. And I used to, I didn't have any voice teachers growing up, but I found a man that if I just sang like him, I didn't realize I was learning great singing technique and great mechanics. And so I wrote him, this was back in the 70s, so I wrote him about the end of August this year. And I said, you know, I just want to thank you because I used to listen to you on the radio and I would sing just like you. And you have been my North Star in my musical sky. You know, you've just been an incredible inspiration. But I want you to know because of your inspiration, what I've gone on to do with my voice and, you know, 30 albums later and Grammy nominations and, you know, I was the last one to sing Amazing Grace for Mother Teresa and just all the wonderful things I've been able to do. And I wanted to thank him. I said, I may never meet you again, you know. And, man, I got an email back from him saying, Sir Tom Jones would love to see you and your wife.
Get out of here.
So my wife and I flew to Las Vegas and spent the evening with Tom Jones.
Is that wild? You had no idea?
That was one blue-eyed brother who could sing, man, you know. And you should have seen his eyes when I walked in and I was greeting him. And I said, man, I used to go around the house thinking, it's not unusual to be loved by anyone. His eyes got bright, you know.
That's
great. It's been an interesting journey.
That's really wild. But in that whole time, you didn't know it was Tom Jones.
Did it again now?
In that whole time, you did not know it was Tom Jones.
Yeah, I knew it was Tom
Jones.
Oh,
you knew it was Tom Jones, whatever. Okay.
But you know, of course, he was so famous. And
You never thought you'd get an answer from him.
No, never, not for 1 minute.
That's beautiful. I like that.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, he sang that night two gospel songs on his program and announced to the audience he had just completed recording his first gospel album. Mm-hmm. And it was released in England, and it was number 2 on the charts, on the Billboard charts in England.
That's wild.
His gospel album.
That's wild. So your radio mentor was Tom Jones.
Yeah. it was. There's no doubt about that, man. That brother had some powerful singing and great technique. And even now, he's 70 years old, and he sings a concert almost every night of his life. I mean, this guy sings a concert 3 months straight every night, hour and a half. And I asked him, because when I sat there listening to him, my jaw was dropped. I've seen great singers in my time, but this man, I finally saw the equivalent, the musical equivalent of a Kenyan or Ethiopian Olympic runner who knew how to pace himself. And just when those last two laps, when he needed that power and those power notes, oh my goodness, he had them. And if you got some musical background, I said to him, you know, one of the best pieces of musical advice I've ever received, I got from you. I heard you being interviewed, and a reporter asked you, my goodness, how do you do that? You know, a concert almost every night of your life. You know, when do you vocalize? You know, oh, when do you warm up? And Tom Jones laughed. He said, in the first half.
That's nice to hear. He's a good human being and not full of himself. That's good to know.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So many people can just forget they're just human beings when they start making a name and become famous, you know.
That's correct.
So you in your time, you also sang for just a unique blend of our presidents in this country.
Yeah.
I mean, Ronald Reagan and George Bush and... President Clinton and, of course, Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Both George Bushes, really.
Yeah.
And Jimmy Carter.
Yeah.
So, and so I, clearly, you do this.
I'm an equal opportunity kind of singer, you know what I mean? And, you know, the most important thing is you do the best that you can to make the greatest impact. And fortunately, my music allows me access that I would probably not have otherwise. I mean, to tell you, there aren't very many African-American-led charities that can tell you, you know, we've got a presence in Washington, Baltimore, Philadelphia, New Jersey, Houston, Memphis, you know, especially dealing with kids. Most of what we do, we kind of hunker down locally and we focus locally, but we have a national vision. But then the other thing, which is critical, is trying to get the public to support what you're doing, and corporations and individuals, because you can't do it all on government resources. You've got to be able to raise private help and get private help. And about 30 years ago, I was singing at the Civic Center in Baltimore. I came down, actually, after singing off of the platform, and a young lady was standing there. She said, excuse me, sir. I turned around. She said, yes. She said, I just heard you sing, and I feel like I can talk to you.
Mm.
Do you have time to talk to me? I said, sure. This is 30 years ago. So she came by home. We lived in Columbia, Maryland at the time.
Mm.
And she came by home, and we talked together and prayed with her and encouraged her. And just before she left, I looked at her, and I said, you know, before you go, I don't know why, but God has impressed me to tell you he is going to bless you and give you. give you an opportunity to speak to millions of people? She said, no, you think God would do that for me? And it was Oprah Winfrey.
Get out of here.
And that's how we met 30 years ago. And she has been the greatest single benefactor of our work.
Wow.
Privately, she has given many millions of dollars so that we could carry on this work to children whose parents are incarcerated.
That's when she was working in television in Baltimore.
Exactly. That's when she was at Jay-Z TV
yes,
in Baltimore.
Absolutely.
And if you remember, she wasn't doing well. They were trying to get rid of her.
They were.
But it taught me something, too. Treat people with respect when you don't know who they are, where they're going, or what they may be able to do for you one day. You know, there's a scripture that says we entertain angels and not even aware of it. You know, and I believe that. So I've learned from treating people with respect, great blessings can come your way. And we've learned that children in need don't know party affiliation. They don't know politics. You know, just so we keep our focus on these children and their needs.
Folks, Whitney Phipps, we've been talking to, he'll be performing this Sunday, September 26th, at the Brown Memorial Park Avenue Church, which is in Bolton Hill, as part of the Tiffany Series. You can get more information or tickets by going to browndowntown.org and click on Whitney Phipps in Concert on the left of the website. Or you can call 410-523-1542. And that's the church of Reverend Andrew Foster Connors, who is a wonderful human being and a tremendous social activist and part of Build. And he's just it's a good church for you to be in, Whitney Phipps. It's a good place.
Wonderful. Well, I'm looking forward to it.
A great pleasure to talk to you.
Well, same here, and wish you all the best. Thank you for your kindness.
Take care. Whitney Phipps will be with us Sunday. Thank you, Whitney. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gabe Pinder, and Felicia Faison. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. I see.